The Democratic gubernatorial field in Maryland for 2022 is getting crowded, but it does have some familiar names. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. One of them is former State Attorney General Doug Gansler. This is his second time around, having run for the Democratic nomination in 2014, but losing out to then-Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown. He garnered just over 24% of the vote to Brown's 51%. He's described himself as a progressive, that and a blue state, but on the Eastern Shore, the political sentiment, of course, is much redder. And we have him in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, well, let me just start out with that, because in your bio, as it were, you talk about being a lifelong resident of Montgomery County, and so you, of course, certainly served as Attorney General from 2007 to 2015. So coming from Montgomery County, what is it that people on the Eastern Shore should be looking for? Because a lot of folks look at the Western Shore and say, we're a little skeptical.
Yeah, well, there's a couple things. One, there's no Eastern Shore candidate, so you're kind of stuck with what you have. But I would submit that my experience and time on the shore and being talking to you many times in the past really is something that people should be comfortable with me. And I, yes, I'm a progressive, but I'm a practical progressive. So when people sort of view the political spectrum, there's concern and people somewhat get scared by some of the Democrats who appear to be way over to the left and sort of self-identifying as such. Now, I have an enormous amount I have a long record of accomplishment of getting things done, of taking on bold challenges and seeing a problem and fixing them. And some of those things happen on the Eastern Shore. And so I think that's what they're looking for. The people that are a little bit more, consider themselves more moderate folks on the shore that are Democrats, want someone that is practical and has experience. I've been in government for 23 years. Many people in this race have never run for anything before, and I think that that's going to really bode well for us. I know, you know, that I know what Warwick Community College is, and others don't. And so I do think there should be a comfort level with the fact that I've held statewide office. I did it for 8 years. I've been a prosecutor for 22 years. And that the fact that my house happens to be in Montgomery County, I don't know that should be a disqualifier, particularly since, again, no one else is from the shore.
Well, let me turn to the economy and the pandemic. How would you approach this in terms of trying to move out of it? We've still got another year before you would even be in office. We've seen Governor Hogan, he decided to end the $300 extra from the federal government for many who have been hit by the pandemic. What's your solution to this, or how would you deal with it, particularly given the inequalities that seem to emerge as we headed into this pandemic?
Yeah, no, look, I think that's exactly the issue, and it's really one of the motivating factors for me deciding to get back into government. I was, as I said, I've been a public servant for 23 years. The last 6 years, though, I've been in the private sector, which I think is actually a good, was a good experience, a good break, gave me a different perspective on things as I go back in to government. But I think that's precisely the issue, sort of how do we come out of COVID? And with this idea of diversity, inclusion, and addressing the inequities that we saw, they've always been there. It's kind of interesting that some people just learning that, that people are discriminated against because of the color of their skin or their socioeconomic status or frankly where they live. And I think there's a real opportunity as we rebuild out of COVID to rebuild Maryland's economy, to make it, you know, the wealthiest state in the country again, and where everybody benefits from the small businesses to the people who work in those small businesses. I'll tell you, one of the things that actually did come rise to the level of things that people were sort of probably less aware of than they should have been is broadband and sort of the effect of not having the sort of the, what they call the last mile, broadband getting to people's homes when people were trying to either do work calls or work from home as they were forced to do, or their children were in school. And this has nothing to do with race, or this is all to do with being in a rural area where we need to make sure that everybody has access to broadband. I remember, you know, I'm a little older, I'm 58 years old. I remember being a kid when, you know, the lights would go out, electricity would go out. That doesn't happen as much anymore, but it did happen. It happened all the time. And in the winter, the heat would go out. In the summer, the air conditioner would go out and the lights would always go out. And you really felt like you were very isolated in your home. And all you cared about was getting that electricity back on. Well, I think that's very similar to where we are with the internet, and people feel isolated and removed and in a situation that needs to be fixed. So that's just one area. And then public health is sort of the other area that really rose to the fore here in terms of the inequities. Again, more socioeconomic, more rural versus suburban versus urban. And those are areas that we need to address as we go forward.
Well, let me ask you this. What specifically would you do about economic inequality in terms of people not having, essentially, not having the jobs that they should have or that they need? Some people are working two jobs. Some people are trying to stretch everything. They got child care issues. How do you address that overall problem?
Yeah, I mean,
specifically.
Yeah, no, one of the good things I think is people, I always view government as being there to sort of help people help themselves, not just sort of do handouts and as a Band-Aid. And I think one of the things that's happened really is part of your question, which is the inequities have come to the fore and people realize that. I mean, people are questioning and looking into how is their company, how is their business dealing with these diversity, inclusion issues and socioeconomic disparity issues. But you mentioned in your question, one of the biggest things, which is childcare. And you've seen families and that have been really pulled apart. And almost half the women, for example, during the pandemic, half of the women in the United States lost their jobs or changed their jobs or had to change their jobs. And much of that is predicated on the lack of available childcare. And so I think government really needs to take a bigger role in that and making sure that there's incentives, economic incentives, put forward for companies to provide childcare and for the government to provide childcare for folks. So that's one of the areas. I think legalizing cannabis is going to be an important component of that because we need to expand pre-K and we need to give economic opportunities and stimulus for small businesses to regrow. And to make sure that we kind of cut down on so much of the red tape that we have and the bureaucracy that we have so that businesses can flourish.
By the way, and what did you make of the governor's decision to cut the $300? Do you think he should have done that?
No. I think it's free money from the federal government, you know, that our people in our state are paying into the federal government and people need the help. And yes, COVID is very much in the rear view mirror of many of us, but we're still coming out of it. And we really haven't hit the low of the economy because the $300 is symbolic of what's been going on, which is all these people lost their jobs, all these people have been displaced, a lot has happened during COVID, and we really haven't seen the economic impact for a lot of people because of sort of this, I call it a Band-Aid, but what you want, the help that's been provided from the federal government. It was important to do. It was the right thing to do. But if they're giving it out to everybody, Maryland should get its share as well.
I want to turn to, by the way, you mentioned about the fact that you have been the Attorney General of the state. And there's, of course, this phrase that's out there, which is defunding the police, which has probably been somewhat mischaracterized. But it does recently put focus on an incident in Ocean City, where we saw a number of African-American young teenagers, as it were, in this confrontation with the Ocean City police. What did you make of that incident, and how do you see that in terms of what we should be doing and looking at reform of police? What is it that we need to be doing, and what can you do as governor, for that matter?
Yeah, so I was an assistant United States attorney under Eric Holder for 6 years. I did mostly homicide cases, but really prosecuted and tried a variety of cases. I argued in front of the Supreme Court of the United States and won a decision 9-0. I was the attorney general. I was the state's attorney of Montgomery County for 8 years and had the Beltway snipers in a number of cases. So I say that because I'm the only person running for governor for either party that has any experience whatsoever in the criminal justice system. And I was involved in criminal justice reform since 1989 when I was the head of the NAACP Criminal Justice Committee. So I've been doing issues and sort of proactive, bold initiatives. I put in community prosecution at the state's attorney's office. And all of that is sort of context for where we are right now. And I don't think actually defund the police was mischaracterized. I think that was a walk back. I think there are knuckleheads out there that think we ought to defund the police. And they'll be the first people that will complain when They call the police department when somebody in their family's been victimized by crime. And so I think we ought to support our police officers. I think they are. We used to have officer friendly. We've moved a little bit away from that. But we need to. But at the same time, we need to look at policing in a much more imaginative, innovative way. There's a lot of things we can do there to sort of bridge that gap of trust between the community and the officers. The incident you just talked about in Ocean City was one that really sort of highlights that problem. And what I think we ought to do is that we ought to have a requirement, as most police departments do, with post-high school education. A two-year degree, you could go to Warwick Community College and get a degree in public safety, for example, where during those 2 years where you're getting your degree, you're being trained in cultural sensitivity, diversity issues, how to reduce the heat of a confrontation and how to sort of walk down that problem. And innovative policing techniques are part of it. And, you know, when I was the state's attorney, we did that. We had our prosecutors go and train and work with the police so that these kind of things would not happen. Because what happens, of course, is these few instances create all these problems, and all of a sudden everyone thinks the police are bad people when they're people that are risking their lives for not very much money to protect us. And I think we need to get back to that balance.
What did you make of the police reform legislation that went through Annapolis, and particularly the qualified immunity, the opening up of some of the records of some of these officers? We had, for instance, Anton Black. We had a situation out there on the Eastern Shore as well, in which an officer's record somehow didn't follow him. Did you like what you saw in that piece of legislation? Do you think qualified immunity is a good thing?
I like that they're talking about trying to that we're having a dialogue about the issue. Sort of where do you land on qualified immunity for police? I do think police officers are different than other people. And, you know, and someone who's been in law enforcement for 22 years, I've sort of seen the challenges that they have. You come into a house, it's a domestic violence situation. There's a lot of passion there. There's kids involved. And how do you respond at the spur of the moment is different than most of us have. So I think we ought to make sure that we strike the right balance there in terms of not looking at police as targets, but as people who are there to enforce the law. But if and when they cross the line, they ought to be held accountable. And how do you do that, I think, is part of this dialogue. Citizen complaint review boards is one way to get at that issue. I think, though, also, and I wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun a few months back, I think this idea of diversity is one that I've practiced my whole life in the government jobs that I've had. I've made sure we've diversified the office, not just by race, but by socioeconomic status and by making sure we have women. By the time I left the state's attorney's office in Montgomery County, the time I left the attorney general's office in Maryland, we had more women supervisors than men. So I think we need to sort of look at that. What I wrote about in the Baltimore Sun was that I think every police department in Maryland ought to have an independent review of its diversity training, its cultural sensitivity training, because reviewing yourself is a little bit like asking the elephant to pass the peanuts. I mean, you have to have an independent review, because I think that's what's most important. Some of the stuff that they've done in Annapolis, sort of getting rid of the idea of getting rid of no-knock warrants or chokeholds and stuff that actually help protect the lives of police officers, are often not. I mean, they're the defendants sometimes are people of color, but a lot of, probably more often than not, they're not. And so we need to sort of really try and address the real issues that are at play here, as opposed to sort of attacking the police and their methods.
And qualified immunity, I think they basically did away with it.
They tried to do away with it. I think they reduced it. Yeah, they did it partially. And that's, I think they haven't landed on where they're going to be there yet. And I think that's sort of the right conversation to have. And, and there ought to be police officers that are doing their job in the midst of preventing crime and taking dangerous people with guns off the streets should be treated somewhat differently. But not to the extent where they're protected from being prosecuted for illegal acts.
I want to turn to the environment. And you've said that you would like to see 100% clean energy. I guess one of the first questions is from the state of Maryland. What does that mean?
Well, it means getting rid of our reliance on fossil fuels and really being a leader in the climate change fight. But we look at, you know, I think we're in an opportunity right now with the president being focused on climate change for the first time. I mean, we talk about it all the time, but it's a real thing. It's an existential threat to our planet. And, you know, one of the things I'm doing now in the private sector is I've been working with states to actually go after fossil fuel companies for their role in climate change to make sure that they're held accountable for what they've done and to help fix the problem going forward. We need to get rid of our reliance on fossil fuels. We need to be a leader here in Maryland nationally on the climate change issue, but it really trickles down to more than that in Maryland, which is protecting the bay. And so the environment itself is what's important here. We have, and I've talked about this on the shore quite often, I want to protect our poultry industry. I want to protect our farmers. One of the first projects that I want to roll up my sleeves and get my hands into is this idea of converting the 2 billion pounds of chicken manure that goes into the bay into power. And if we do that, because we have the technology, this isn't, you know, the Jetsons or something in the future. This is real and it's now. We can do that. And then the byproduct that people complain about of the poultry industry becomes a positive thing. And we can have more poultry. We can have more open space. We have more agriculture. So these are the kinds of things we need to look at because that also contributes to climate change. I want to make sure that we have tier 3 charging stations for electric cars. I mean, the private sector is actually driving that. GM and all these companies are saying, we're going to be all electric vehicles by whatever year. Well, we as a state, we need to support that because that's the biggest cause of pollution.
Of course, one of the things that struck me is that we have a project off the off Ocean City, the offshore windmills. There are a lot of folks in Ocean City who don't like that because it might interfere with the view, might interfere with tourism. As I've looked at this issue, by the way, it doesn't look as if it's feasible to push these things out any further than what they're planned for. What's your position on whether or not these things should be out there? Because on the one hand, you say we should have renewable energy. That's certainly offshore. On the other hand, you've got resorts who say, wait a minute, it might hurt our tourism, our income in terms of people coming to the resorts.
Yeah, I think that's a bogus argument. I mean, I don't think it's going to hurt people coming to resorts at all. I mean, these are 11 miles out. They're barely specks on the horizon. I would argue that people might look at it the other way, which is this is great that they're creating this clean energy source. It's a source of jobs. Can you imagine the amount of jobs that would be here on the Eastern Shore to have that project in there? It's a speck on the horizon. I just think that's an argument for people that don't like change. I think this that we need to have that as part of our portfolio to get to carbon neutral status. And I you know, there's a lot of things that they've said are going to ruin Ocean City as we know it. None of that has happened, and I certainly don't think wind energy would do that.
So you would disagree with, say, for instance, the mayor of Ocean City who says, hey, these things should be pushed out further. We're concerned about it. You disagree with them then?
Well, they should be pushed out as far as feasible. And you know, you don't want them 10 feet off where the waves are breaking and the kids are running into them. We're talking about 11 miles out there. I mean, they're pretty far out there, and they're a speck in the view. If you're looking for them, you'll see them potentially way out there. But the other side of that is that's where the wind is. And that's, you know, it really doesn't get in anybody yet. Eventually you get into the shipping lane. So you have to, that's the feasibility issue. And you got to keep them within the shipping lanes. But I think we ought to do it. I think we ought to figure out how to do it soon. We ought to create incentives to do it. And we'll all live longer and we'll breathe cleaner air.
You've come out for the legalization of cannabis, as you mentioned a moment ago. I think I saw a quote says, it's about time, I think is what changed your mind?
Well, it didn't change. I never was on the other side of that issue. I mean, I never.
Okay.
I remember like years ago when I was the state's attorney in Montgomery County, probably 20 years ago, this issue came up about it being disproportionately used to arrest people of color, the marijuana issue. And we looked in our jail on that day, just a random day, and we had nobody that was being held for possession of marijuana. Now, that clearly happens in other places, but not where I was. Dealing, it's a different issue. But I think the actual, I think it's going to happen. Its time has come. The other states have it. And Maryland's behind on that. It's a little bit like online gambling. We're going to have that. Look, nobody wants people to be, no one wants their kids to be smoking marijuana. So many kids do now anyway. They seem to smoke more marijuana, THC, or vape than they do drink almost. But that doesn't mean it should be illegal when every kid can get marijuana or any person can get cannabis right now if they want it. And we're not taxing it, and we're not making sure that it's healthy, that it's not spiked with bad poisons that are killing people.
Because, I mean, the comparison, for instance, to alcohol is that if you're under the age of 21, it's still a good chance that you can get the alcohol. Would that be a similar problem for something like cannabis? I mean, obviously, I assume you have, for instance, a 21-year-old sort of cutoff, right?
Yeah.
But some people would argue that then that allows younger people to get easier access to it.
Perhaps. I mean, yeah. I think that the cannabis is so prevalent right now in high schools that they're getting it some way, and I'd much rather have them, if they're going to get it, I much have it regulated and make sure that it's a safe product. Not that, I mean, smoking is not a good idea. As Attorney General, we went after tobacco companies, and that's who did, and made sure that it was transparent and we addressed people's health concerns. And we're going to need to do that with cannabis as well. But I don't think the accessibility issue, I mean, the accessibility issue cuts both ways. I don't think there'll be, you don't see people illegally dealing alcohol on the streets, and because there's a place to get it legally. Now they have fake IDs and all that kind of stuff. That will also happen under cannabis, but you won't have the people getting killed for pot, and you won't have people standing on the street corner selling illegal cannabis.
Would you favor some kind of public campaign to discourage its use?
Of course. I mean, with children?
Of cannabis, yeah.
For the youth.
Or even perhaps even people, even adults. I mean, we have campaigns, for instance, against smoking, right? Even though it's legal.
Yeah, I think it comes in between smoking tobacco and alcohol. If you smoke cigarettes, you are going to die of lung cancer. You will probably die of something before, you might die of something before that, but you will die of lung cancer. If you drink alcohol, you may or may not become an alcoholic. You may or may not drive drunk. A lot of things could happen to you that are bad. Cannabis is somewhere in between that, and the way the form of cannabis is, there's so many ways of ingesting cannabis now that are not through smoking and getting smoke in your lungs, I think that we certainly would not have a public health campaign to promote it, and how much are people going to push against it, we'll have to see what the health officials think.
In terms of the shore and agriculture and even the watermen, there's a tension between environmentalists on the one hand who say we need to preserve the bay and the emphasis on restrictions on both watermen and on farmers. Farmers push back, often saying they're not the problem. It's certainly on the Eastern Shore that it's those guys up in Pennsylvania and New York that are the problem. And the watermen themselves sort of chafe under a lot of the restrictions. Where would you find that sweet spot to make sure that you balance those two issues?
Well, I think that the answer is in the question, which is finding the sweet spot and balancing those issues. and it's true. I mean, we look at it as a very binary thing. You're either for the environment and you're against farmers and watermen or vice versa. And I just don't think that's the case. I think farmers have done an enormous amount to try and meet the environmental concerns in the middle, and so have watermen, frankly. But I also think we should not have a myopic view of it and say, all right, let's let sort of free rein on oysters this year and never have any more for the next 100 years to come. And so I do think that there are sort of restrictions that should be met with. The most important thing, I guess, this is more of a personality problem or quality of mind, which is I like to listen to people. I like to talk to people. I like to hear from people. So I want to have the watermen and the farmers help create the solution to the perceived problem and work with them to get there. And I think this idea of, for example, converting chicken manure to power is, I mean, that's the biggest single source of pollution in the Bay in Maryland. Now, the idea that it's coming from Pennsylvania and New York is very real. I mean, particularly Pennsylvania, less so New York. And the Susquehanna provides half of the water to the Bay, and most of it's pretty pristine through New York. It comes to Pennsylvania, Lancaster County in particular, and there's an enormous amount of pollution that then comes to us. So we need to, as a governor, I can do compacts with other states and hopefully work with Democratic governors in other states to try and solve this problem. As Attorney General, I was able, and I did, prosecute corporate polluters every day. and worked with people on the shore to address issues on a smaller scale involving pollution as well.
I want to turn to January 6th. We all witnessed it. The local congressman has been reluctant to call it an insurrection. And in fact, here on the Eastern Shore, there's a number of Democrats who've now decided they're going to run against Congressman Harris. What did you make of that scene on January 6th? And what do you make of a congressman who seems to say, no, it wasn't an insurrection, that he seems to be playing it down somewhat? Because that is a very hot issue, by the way, here on the Eastern Shore when it comes to opposition to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's like he was watching a different game than the rest of us. I mean, I was sitting there watching television. I was sad. I mean, my sentiment was sad. This is, you know, the greatest country in the world, and all these people came out from under their rocks and started crawling up the walls of the Capitol, and it was just so disconcerting. But on the one hand, there's some positive that came out of it, which is that Republicans, look, we had a mentally ill, narcissistic, dictator wannabe president at the time who promoted this activity. And then it became, you know, he lied with fluidity every day and he did all these things, he raped women and all that. But now you're watching television saying, I'm not that person. I'm a Republican, but I'm not a person that's going to wave a Confederate flag and trespass on the Capitol and start breaking things and stealing stuff and killing police officers. So that gives people a step back and saying, do I want to have an Andy Harris? Do I want somebody who's going to support that kind of activity or pretend it didn't happen when we all saw it on television? So I think that it's really the takeaway could be viewed as sort of positive. They came out from under the rocks, and all this white supremacy and all that is now in the public dialogue, and people are saying that is really I'm not that person. You know, I may believe in lower tax or higher tax or this or that, but I'm not that. And so I think he's got some issues. I endorsed Heather Mazur in that race on the Democratic side, and because I'm somebody that brings people together, and she and I actually ran against each other for governor last
time. That's right.
And I think it's important to have people that are rational, sane, and view the world as it is, rather than how they wish it were to be, in office. So I hope he gets defeated, and you know it'll be tough. And redistricting obviously will be part of that.
Well, what do you say then to the Trump supporter who still supports the president, perhaps does not view the storming of the Capitol in the same way? There are a lot of folks here on the Eastern Shore. I'm sure that you've driven down the roadways and you've seen a number of Trump signs. What do you say to them?
I say they got to grow up and get over it. I mean, it's ridiculous. The guy, and look, Trump's policies, you can sort of quibble about one way or the other, but my biggest problem with him is the way that he degraded the office of the presidency. You grew up thinking the person that was president of the United States is somebody who's our leader and someone who has a moral compass and ethical, and you know that's a job to aspire to be the most powerful person in the country and in the world. And this guy really undermined our status throughout the world, and he was an embarrassment. And then it was embarrassing and sad to watch what happened on January 6th, and the people that are, and the kind of good thing that you'd like to say to those same people is he's gone. He lost. There was no election fraud. That was ridiculous that as well. There's no evidence of such a thing. And he's lost and he's gone. Let's move forward and kind of see what the Republican Party is going to look like going forward, and frankly, what the Democratic Party is going to look like going forward as well. I mean, Joe Biden won that election through as a moderate. He had progressive values, as I do. I was 5 years ahead on marriage equality. I started the first civil rights department in the history of Maryland. I was the president of all the attorneys general in the United States during the national mortgage foreclosure crisis. We brought billions of dollars here to Maryland and around the country to keep people in their homes. But on the other hand, I view the world as a practical place and with reality checks. And I think that that's where the Democratic Party needs to get to, and the Republican Party needs to just get over Trump and move forward.
We've been speaking with former State Attorney General Doug Gansel. He is running for the Democratic nomination for governor in 2022. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.